So welcome everyone. So the strong gravity seminar speaker today is Chase Kimball from Northwestern University. And Chase is a graduate student. And today, I guess he will talk about what compact object mergers can tell us. Right, Chase, please take it away.
Sorry, just one second. There we go. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. So thank you for having me. My name is Chase Kimball, and yes, I'm a graduate student at Northwestern University and also a member of the LIGO collaboration. And as Juan said, I want to talk today about what compact object mergers and possibly remergers can tell us about astrophysics. So just a bit of background. Obviously, I'm interested in compact objects, so black holes and neutron stars. And the tricky thing about compact objects is they don't emit much light, so they're hard to detect electromagnetically. In the case, sometimes we'll have like a rapidly rotating neutron star, and we can observe that as a pulsar. But really, with black holes, we only detect them electromagnetically through how they interact with their environments. So on the right here, we have a low mass X-ray binary, an illustration of one, where you have a black hole accreting matter from a companion. And what we detect is the X-rays emitted as the matter falls onto the accretion disk and spirals into the black hole. But with the advent of gravitational wave astronomy, we're now able to detect black holes and neutron stars through the gravitational waves they emit. Specifically, everything we've observed so far have been the gravitational waves emitted when they merge as either binary black holes, binary neutron stars, or neutron star black holes. Sometimes I will refer to these as BBH, BNS, and NSBH, respectively. Really the questions that I'm going to address in this talk, hopefully, are kind of fall into two categories. One is, how often do these compact objects merge? And what can that tell us about black hole and neutron star formation? And then the main question I'm really concerned with is a simple one, which is, how are LIGO's biggest black holes made? And it may not be obvious right now why that's a mystery, but we'll get to that in a second. Before I dive into these questions, I just want to give a tiny bit of astrophysics background that may come up later. It's just a few slides. So what we see in our detectors is this strain, which is called a chirp, and it encodes the final stages of the in-spiral of a compact object binary. And it's through the frequency evolution. You can see the frequency increases as the compact objects in spiral and their period decreases, and then the increase in amplitude of gravitational the increase in amplitude of the strain. And it's these signatures which allow us to extract information about the source binaries, specifically their masses, their mass ratio, how they're spinning, how their spins are oriented, and how far away they are, things like that. And this is parameter estimation, and it's done by the collaboration. And it gives us hints as to how the sources are formed. So broadly speaking, formation channels for compact object binaries fall into two categories. The first is isolated binary evolution, where the compact objects form together from stars that form from the same cloud of matter and evolve together, usually involving some stage or some mechanism where you can shed angular momentum so that the binary can merge within a Hubble time. And then the other very large and diverse class of formation channels fall into dynamical formation. And this is where the compact objects don't necessarily form together. They can swap partners. Sometimes you can have a tertiary companion drive an inner binary to high eccentricities and then merger. And all these interactions happen in dense dynamical environments where strong interactions are common, and merger products can be retained and things like that. And then just quickly, one of, I think, the main signatures of these formation channels that we try and look at is the spin orientation of the emerging components. And so generally speaking, with isolated binary evolution, because the compact objects form together from the same cloud of matter, the spins are, we expect them to be aligned up to some small misalignment due to supernova kicks, et cetera. But generally, we expect the spins to be aligned with each other and with the orbital angular momentum of the binary. And then in dynamical formation, there's no reason to assume this because you have compact objects swapping partners in binaries and receiving strong torques from dynamical interactions. So you'd expect the spins to be oriented isotropically. So with that, I want to talk about, well, what compact objects have we actually detected so far? So this is a plot that is near and dear to my heart, and not just because it was made at Northwestern. Through watching its evolution, I can really trace out the course of my PhD. So to start in pink and yellow, we have the black holes and the neutron stars that we've detected through electromagnetic observations. And then here in blue and orange, we have the black holes and neutron stars detected through gravitational waves in the first two observing runs of LIGOS detectors. And this was the state of affairs when I joined the collaboration and started my PhD. You can see we started kind of modestly, I guess, 10 binary black holes. You can see the components, the merging components, and then the merger products at higher masses. And so 10 binary black holes and one binary neutron star, which was a really exciting event, and it allowed multi-messenger astronomy and all this cool stuff, but it's the last I'm going to talk about it. Then over the course of the first and then the second half of the third observing run of LIGO, we've detected, frankly, an annoying number of compact objects to the point where now most of the black holes that we know about because of gravitational waves, which is actually a really exciting thing. So my work over the past few years has been concerned both with this picture, broadly speaking, as a population, specifically how often these binaries merge in their different flavors of binary black hole, binary neutron star, and neutron star black hole, as well as with the outliers in this plot. So that's from the lightest objects, the binary neutron star mergers, the most unequal mass ratios, the neutron star black holes, as well as 1908-14, which we'll get to in a second because we don't quite know what it is. And then largely with the most massive objects in this graph, the massive binary black hole mergers. So first I'm gonna start out by talking about merger rates. And so that I don't bore you to death, I do wanna start with, why should we care about merger rates? So the first thing I'll say, which I don't have a slide for because it kind of just occurred to me to say, is that gravitational wave merger rates are different than rates, the detection rates that we are predicted because of electromagnetic observations. And that's because with gravitational waves, we really understand our selection effects. And well, with electromagnetic observations, you have, observing campaigns are usually targeted. And so there's a human element to the selection effects. But with gravitational waves, we know when our detector's turned on, we know the noise, and so we can really have robust rates. Okay, so the reason I care about formation rates can be summed up by what other people predict rates should be. So this is one prediction for a binary black hole merger rate through isolated binary evolution by Chris Belchinsky through population synthesis. And you can see it spans many orders of magnitude. Even in 2020, we still don't have all these knobs that you can turn in population synthesis models nailed down. And then it gets even worse when you look at all of the predicted merger rates. I know that you can't really quite read this plot. It's meant to be overwhelming. But this is a collection of merger rates put together in a great review paper by Ilya Mandel and Flora Brokgarten. And you can see now when you throw in everything from primordial black holes to isolated binary evolution and the dynamical formation channels, your formation rates that are predicted span 7-8 orders of magnitude. This plot gets a little less stressful when we throw in our gravitational wave constraint, sorry, our merger rate constraints from gravitational wave observations. And the takeaway from this slide should be that, okay, we can't rule out any specific channel here as being the dominant formation channel for binary black holes, but we can start to constrain the knobs that you turn in population synthesis so that within given models, we know that, okay, we can't turn these knobs here this way because we're going to be over-predicting the merger rate. And this also applies to the neutron star black hole merger rate, which I'm really happy about, because before we before the third observing run, we only had an upper limit because we hadn't detected.
Chase, can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
So I see these dots within the bar. So what are these dots?
Oh, so these are just within the paper that's cited. These are the like the models in whatever table had the merger rates.
Oh, okay.
So they represent different settings of your population synthesis knobs.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. So yeah, in the third observing run, we were able to go from just an upper limit on the neutron star black hole merger rate to a pretty well-constrained merger rate that will get better with more detections. As with the last slide here, for you, really, we can only rule out one model or one formation channel as being, you know, dominating the merger rate, and that's globular clusters. This is because neutron star black hole formation is suppressed in globular clusters because black holes tend to dominate the core, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Yeah, so as with binary black holes, we're able to start constraining the constraining within given models, how we can turn knobs, et cetera. But another thing that I want you to take away from these slides is that besides not being able to rule out any merger rate as the dominant channel, really, I think that's that question or that pursuit is a fool's errand, because really you don't expect that nature only forms compact object binaries in one way. You'd expect there to be contributions from a variety of formation channels. That being said, we can learn something by looking at within given categories of compact object mergers. We can learn things about the outliers by and about physics by looking at the outliers, and their merger rates. And so I just want to so first of all, this is a plot of the total mass of our gravitational wave detections versus mass ratio. And it's through this that we can divide our observations into neutron star black holes, binary black holes, and binary neutron stars. So a lot of the work I've done for the collaboration has been calculating merger rates for subclasses of these categories. So real quick, I want to call out really the two most interesting events in my mind, and that is 1908-14. And 1908-14 is extraordinary for a couple of reasons. One, it has an extremely small mass ratio of about 10 to 1. And this makes it really hard to produce with a standard population synthesis models. And second, it has a frustrating secondary mass that lies within our limits of what we think the heaviest neutron stars can be for some models. So in green and orange here, we have the posterior for the maximum neutron star mass, and you can see it's not completely ruled out. So it's hard to tell whether or not this is a neutron star or a black hole. And so when we detected this, we also wanted to, so this event really stood out as kind of a new class of compact object merger because of its extreme mass ratio and ambiguous, and the ambiguous nature of the secondary. And so we computed a merger rate for 1908-14 like systems. And it ends up pretty high at about 1 to 23 mergers per cubic gigaparsec per year. And what this means is that even if your population synthesis model can nail down the, or you know, correctly predict the neutron star black hole merger rate and the binary black hole merger rate, if you aren't producing NSBHs and BBHs that look like 1908-14 with extreme mass ratios, then you aren't, your model is not capturing nature correctly. There's something missing. And so this is, I think it is the most difficult observation to explain. And to date, as far as I know, no population synthesis model has been able to both nail down all of the broad rates in NSBH, BBH, and BNS, as well as this subclass of compact object merger. So finally, I want to talk about the event that means the most to me because it sparked most of my work outside of the collaboration, and that is 1905-21. So this was an event that was extraordinary, first and foremost, because it was the most massive binary ever detected at the time. The merger product was also the first ever observed intermediate mass black hole. And then really, I think the biggest superlative here is not that it's the most massive, but that it has components that have that fall into a very specific range that is tricky to explain. And this is the parent stability mass gap. So just a bit of background here. In massive stars, their cores undergo runaway pair production. So this is where photons are converted into electrons and positrons, which means that you're converting kinetic energy into rest mass energy. And then that means that the support in the core drops and you have rapid contraction, which ignites the carbon oxygen core and will either result in parent stability supernova, where the star is completely ripped apart and no remnant is left behind, or you have partial detonation of the core in a series of pulses where you eject mass until you get down to a mass that can directly collapse into a black hole. And we call this parent stability supernova. So what this does is it opens up a gap between about 50 and 120 solar masses where you don't expect black holes to form from supernova. And this mass range, though, does have some uncertainty, specifically in where the lower edge of the mass gap is. And these uncertainties come from how you treat nuclear reaction rates, specifically the carbon-oxygen rate, how you treat stellar rotation, convection, as well as how you treat stellar collisions. And so what that means is that the location of this mass gap actually encodes some pretty cool physics. But I'd say that if we want to use observations like 1905-21 to infer anything about the physics here, then we need to account for the possibility that black holes in this mass gap weren't formed from stellar collapse at all. So how could they have been formed? Through hierarchical mergers. So real quick, just a bit of nomenclature here. By hierarchical merger, I mean two black holes that may have been formed from stellar collapse that merge and produce a 2G black hole. And then if that black hole is retained in its dynamical environment, it can go on and merge again. It can merge, for instance, with a 1G black hole that was formed from stellar collapse and form a 1G, 2G merger, or with another hierarchical form black hole, so a 2G, 2G merger. But in order to form these hierarchical mergers, you need dense dynamical environments. That's because a merger product in the field, in isolated binary evolution, so the disk of the galaxy, isn't expected to go on to find other black holes to merge with. So we wouldn't be able to detect it again. And so these dense dynamical environments, like globular clusters, active galactic nuclei, and nuclear star clusters, the key thing is that they need to retain their merger products so that the merger product can go on to merge again and we can detect. But for now, I'm going to focus on globular clusters because that's what the analysis I'm going to talk about really focused on. And as we develop the analysis, we want to start including these other dynamical environments, but we're not quite there yet. So just a quick note on globular clusters. They are gravitationally bound balls of stars and their remnants, black holes and neutron stars. I see a raised hand.
Yes, we'll do.
So what about the spin properties of these sources? So apart from the masses, can you also talk about something like the spin properties to understand them?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up because it kind of leads into the next thing. So one thing that we expect with a hierarchical merger is that you'd have a hierarchically formed black hole would be spinning. And this is because even if two component black holes have zero spin, the merger product is going to have a spin of about 0.67 just from the angular orbital momentum of the binary. And then the other thing you expect is because these form in dynamical environments that these spins aren't necessarily aligned. So on a population level, you'd expect an isotropic spin distribution. So yes, that brings us to globular clusters, the gravitationally bound, through mass segregation, you have the massive black holes sink to the core of the cluster, which allows lots of dynamical interactions and mergers, which is great. But then the one thing to keep in mind is that merger products will receive a kick upon merger if you have anisotropic gravitational wave emission. And these kicks can exceed 1,000 kilometers per second, which is above you know, the standard escape velocity for a globular cluster. So we need to keep this in mind when we perform our analysis. So this brings us to, you know, the question that I wanted to answer, which is how are these massive black holes formed? And so what we want to do is look at the population of binary black holes, they're both their masses and spins, when we allow for this hierarchical formation channel. And then we want to look at, okay, well, then what happens to that edge of that mass gap and how we infer things about the physics of that mass gap. And then finally, can we actually identify hierarchical mergers in the gravitational wave catalogs so that we can account for things that are square in the mass gap, but that doesn't mean that the mass gap isn't there. And in order to do this, we need hierarchical Bayesian inference. I'm just going to sketch out this process. Like any good endeavor, it starts with the data. So this is our, you know, waveform that we see, or the strain that we see in the detector. And then the source parameters that are inferred through parameter estimation that the collaboration does. And so this is our masses, spins, mass ratios, luminosity distance, things like that. And then you can take those source parameters and then write down a population model. So now this is some model. Here I have a power law that is where your source, your distribution of your source parameters are parameterized by some hyperparameter. So maybe M1 to the negative alpha in this case for a power law. So we can write down that population model, combine it with the source parameters of all of our detections in the catalog, and we can get out posteriors on the hyperparameters. So these are no longer distributions over M1 or M2 or masses, spins, et cetera, but distributions over the hyperparameters that govern our population models. So for the simple model I wrote down, this would be the minimum and maximum mass, as well as the power loss slope.
Sorry, so this is assuming that all LIGO mergers are following these hierarchical mergers, or, I mean, what if only a subset follows these hierarchical mergers?
Yeah. So only a subset. Here I'm just sketching out broadly, like your population model can be anything. Typically the population models that LIGO publishes in their populations paper have, well, I shouldn't say they only have one component, but we always have some simple like power law with a, you know, truncated power law, maybe with some extra features, et cetera. And what I'm going to talk about is what happens when you specifically try and encode into that population model hierarchical mergers. But you don't necessarily say that all mergers are hierarchical, because that's definitely not what we expect.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, so finally, what we can do is then take out our hyperposteriors, which allow us to build our inferred population, combine them with the source parameters of the individual detections, and we can get out the probability that an individual detection is a hierarchical merger. So that's the broad outline of the analysis I'm about to present. So to get things started, I want to talk about our assumptions. First of all, I do want to say, as I'm presenting this, this analysis has been applied to successive gravitational wave catalogs, so GWTC1, GWTC2, and we're currently applying it to GWTC3. And in each of those papers, the analysis has evolved, and specifically the spin distribution has changed. But the one thing that hasn't changed is our mass model, not necessarily because it's the best thing out there, but just because it conveniently captures some of the features of the parent stability mass gap. So I'm going to start with the mass model. We have a truncated power law, like I showed before, with a minimum and maximum mass, but then we also add a Gaussian component whose location, its mean, and width can vary, as well as the fraction. So that as well as the fraction of mergers that we throw into this Gaussian component. So there's some mixing fraction lambda, and this is meant to capture, and we're not sure if it does, this theoretical buildup of masses around, say, 35 or 40 solar masses due to pulsational parent stability. And this is where there's a region of, here, let me actually go back. There's a region of carbon-oxygen core mass where you start mapping down to black hole masses in this narrow range right below the parent stability mass gap. So you'd expect there to be some buildup of mergers there. So that's what we hope that the Gaussian component captures. So given our 1G population, we need to then infer, okay, what are 2G populations look like? And so to do that, we use simple transfer functions that are derived from just kind of common sense and then checked against actual in-body simulations of all their clusters. So first of all, you'd expect that, for instance, the minimum 2G and the maximum 2G mass should be about twice the minimum 1G and maximum 1G mass. You'd also expect that if you have a 1G, 2G population, that the mass ratio should peak at about a half. And then, as I said before, you'd expect the 2G spin distribution to peak at about 0.67. And this is because you have isotropic spins, so they should average out. And when you have zero spins, you get a merger product with a spin of 0.67. So this describes how we get the shape of our populations, our 1G, 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 2G, and 2G, 2G populations. We don't go to higher order populations because merger products are hard to retain in globular clusters, so you'd expect them to have a negligible contribution to the overall population. But it's well and good to have the shape of these populations, but we need to be able to mix them to get an overall population. And the driving force between how these populations are mixed is going to come down to what fraction of the population of 1G merger products are actually retained in your cluster so they can go on to merge again and be detected. And this largely comes down to the spin of our 1G population. So here we've computed point-wise over a grid, the fraction of 1G merger products with spins of chi 1, chi 2, and mass ratio q that would be retained in a nominal globular cluster with an escape velocity of about 60 kilometers per second, which is our default model. And as you can see, it depends heavily on spin. So once you move to non-negligible spins, you have recoil velocities, these kicks that can exceed 1,000 kilometers per second and eject the merger product from the merger environment. And so what we do is for each draw of our hyperparameters for the 1G population, we fold in our spin and mass ratio populations into this calculation to get out the fraction of 1G merger products that are actually retained given that population draw. Okay. And then we mix our populations proportional to that fraction in kind of a common sense way. You'd expect the relative rate of 1G, 2G mergers to 1G, 1G mergers to scale like the that retention fraction. But you'd expect the relative rate of 2G, 2G mergers to 1G, 1G mergers to scale like that retention fraction squared, because now you have to retain two second generation mergers. And then the constant out front of proportionality is just taken directly from in-body simulations. Okay, so that brings us to applications of this analysis that we've done. So first of all, we have GWTC1. This was really a methods paper that we put out because we wanted to get this analysis into the exceptional event paper that we put out for, that the collaboration put out for 19.05.21, which I won't talk about the results here, but you can go and read that paper, it's interesting. So to start with, as I said, our spin model changes with each time we apply this. So I just want to quickly describe what's going on. We have two models here. One is the default parameterization what was the default parameterization for LIGO, which was a beta distribution restricted to non-singular values, which means it is flexible, but it can't peak at zero. So because of that, and because of a paper that was put out around this time by Fuller and Ma, that predicted that black holes should form with very low spins, we also extended this model to include a delta function at zero and then some mixing fraction to allow for some population of black holes that are formed with zero or very, very low spin. And so that's in blue here. And that really brings us to what I think was the main takeaway from this paper, is that we learned that not all 1G black holes have zero spin. So even with just the 10 events in GWTC1, we were able to constrain lambda zero here, which is the mixing fraction or the fraction of black holes that come from the delta function. We were able to constrain it away from one. So not all black holes have low spin. And then the other thing that we, I don't know if we learned it as much as confirmed what we expected, was that high 2G, 2G to 1G, 1G rates correlate with low spin. And this is because of what I showed you in the plot with the kids, that when you have a large population of low spinning black holes, so when you have larger lambda naught, you retain more merger products and then have higher hierarchical rates. So finally, we computed for each of the observations in GWTC1, the probability that that merger was a hierarchical merger. So here is the relative probability, so the odds ratio of a 1G1G, or sorry, 1G2G to 1G1G merger scenario, and then in green, 2G2G to 1G1G. And as you can see, what we found is that in GWTC1 at least, all of the mergers can be explained and are favored to be 1G1G mergers. But as expected, 170729, which at the time was the most massive binary in our catalog, has the highest probability of being a hierarchical merger. Though we found that that changed as our population exploded in the first half of the third observing run with GWTC2. So quickly, I'm going to shout out the change to the spin distribution. Here, we've gotten rid of the non-singular beta distribution only model because we don't because we want to allow for spins to peak at zero if that's where they peak. So we replaced it with a truncated Gaussian where the mean is allowed to peak, the mean is allowed to be outside of the physical range of 0 to 1 so that it can either peak at 0, at 1, or anywhere in between. And indeed, we find that the spin distribution peaks at 0. But we kept our zero spin model, which is really the mixture model with a beta distribution and that zero spin parameter. And the takeaway from this application is that now we're starting to see evidence for hierarchical mergers within LIGO's population. So specifically, we find in favor of 1905-21 and 1905-19, which is another massive merger, we find in favor of them being formed hierarchically versus non-hierarchically. Though we find that weakly. We favor it with an odds ratio of about like 2. But when you put together all of the mergers in the catalog, we find that GWTC2 contains a 2G black hole with a greater than 96% probability for our default cluster model. And we also prefer including the hierarchical channels to excluding them. So we run our analysis with turning them off with a base factor of about 5.
So if now that you have this globular cluster model, so if you do a rate calculation, like how many events do you expect in this GWTC2 catalog?
So we actually marginalize over the total rate and only infer these relative 1G, 2G, and 2G, 2G rates.
Yeah, but in principle, you can do the rate calculation, right? So
Yeah.
Any 1G plus 2G mergers in this catalog if you do the rate calculation?
So what we find is, so here we're finding roughly 2 of the mergers in our catalog are hierarchical. And this falls within, if you do the calculation by taking LIGO's total rate and then folding in these relative rates, that falls within the margin of the fraction of black holes you'd expect to be formed hierarchically given your relative merger rates when you fold in selection effects.
Okay, I guess Suadeep has raised hand. Suadeep.
Yeah, thanks. So I have a question regarding the mass distribution. So in your analysis, do you still keep the mass distribution completely Reshef independent?
Sorry, I missed the last part.
Do you keep the mass distribution of the black holes completely Reshef independent?
Oh, yes, we do. That's a really good caveat to point out. It's something we might include in the future, but here we are assuming that the mass distribution does not evolve with redshift. I know Maya Fishbach has done work on looking at including redshift evolution that's been published in LIGO populations papers, but that's something that we leave out here.
Yeah. I guess I can rephrase my question a bit.
Yeah.
So you did this comparison, right? You had this plot. People did this rate calculation for global clusters, and the infer rate is much lower than the measure rate from LIGO, right? For all the black holes. And then now you're considering the 1G plus 2G mergers from this global cluster channel, which I assume would be much lower than this 1G plus 1G from global clusters. So what I'm wondering is if you do the rate calculation for this 1G plus 2G from global clusters, the theoretical rate, is it consistent with finding some event in GWTC2?
So that would depend on obviously the fraction of mergers that we expect to come from globular clusters. And that's actually the caveat I'm going to point out next, which is here we are assuming the most optimistic case for hierarchical mergers, which is that everything comes from globular clusters. But that's obviously not what we expect. So we haven't performed that calculation just because there's no reason to expect to get out the correct number there. You can think of this as upper limits on the relative merger rates by ignoring other formation channels.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, no problem. So that brings us to really the caveat I was just talking about, which is this was a methods paper that we wanted to do to start being able to pick out hierarchical mergers and include them in our populations. But we made an extremely simplifying assumption that doesn't represent reality, which is that not only do all mergers come from globular clusters, but that all globular clusters have the same escape velocity, the same morphology. Because our default analysis was with a globular cluster with a mass of 5 times 10 to the 5 solar masses and a half-light radius of a parsec. And this might be representative of maybe a typical globular cluster, but globular clusters come in all shapes and sizes, not to mention binary black hole mergers don't only happen in globular clusters. So to begin to address this, in our application to GWTC2, we performed our analysis with a range of morphologies of globular clusters and found exactly what we expected, which is that our results really depend strongly on the central escape velocity of your dynamical environment. So working from left to right, what we find is that as you moved to globular clusters with higher escape velocities, the maximum mass that you infer, which is the lower edge of that mass gap that encodes all that unique physics, that maximum mass decreases. So this is the median maximum mass inferred as a function of escape velocity. And as you can see, when you move to very low escape velocities, or if you can think of turning off the hierarchical channels as setting the escape velocity to zero, you have a maximum mass that is kind of above the range of what we expect for the lower edge of the mass gap. But then as you increase the escape velocity, what happens is the relative rate of 2G, 2G, and 1G merger and 1G, 1G mergers increases because more 1G merger products are retained, which means that you can start shoving some of our detections into the hierarchical population. So that means that you don't need a maximum mass that's really high in order to account for our massive black holes, like 19 to 521. And what that means is that as you increase the escape velocity, the odds of 19 to 521 being 2G, 2G versus 1G, 1G increase. And in square here is our nominal model. So we're really kind of at this cusp where we're weakly finding in favor of 19 to 521 being a hierarchical merger. The other thing to point out here is all these dots are colored by the relative Bayes factor running the model including the hierarchical population versus excluding it. And so what you can see is for all of our models, we favor including the hierarchical channels. We favor it by a factor of about 5 to 1 in our nominal model. But then quickly, as we move to higher escape velocities, we find much larger preference for the hierarchical models. And our largest preference is actually for an escape velocity of about 300 kilometers per second. The problem with this is that globular clusters don't have escape velocities of 300 kilometers per second. So we need to start, but sorry, they don't have that escape velocity, but I think this starts hinting at maybe the type of dynamical environments in which you'd expect hierarchical mergers to form. And so that brings me to the next extension of our analysis, an application of GWTC3. I will warn you, this is all super preliminary and is kind of a first pass at it, but I just want to give you a sketch of what I've been interested in. So as I said, if we're going to restrict ourselves to just globular clusters, we should account for the fact that globular clusters come in all shapes and sizes and therefore many different escape velocities. So this is a plot from a paper by Fabio Antonini and Fred Razio, which has in orange here is the distribution of escape velocities of globular clusters in the Milky Way. Now, I could go and take this distribution of escape velocities as my distribution of escape velocities for mergers, but what that doesn't account for is that more massive globular clusters and more compact globular clusters actually form more mergers. So here is a plot from a paper by Kyle Kramer, which demonstrates this. As you move left to right on the x-axis, you increase the total mass, and you can see an increase in the number of mergers produced in that model. And then as you move to more compact globular clusters, you also increase the number of binary black hole mergers. And because the escape velocity depends on the mass and the compactness of the globular cluster, you'd expect globular clusters with higher escape velocities to actually produce more mergers. So we need to weight this distribution by that tendency. And so just as a first pass at this, I did kind of the stupid easy thing and looked at the models behind this plot and just fit the relative rate as a function of escape velocity. And that gives us kind of in blue here is a by-eye approximation of this distribution. And then in orange is when you weight it by the increase in mergers that you get with escape velocity. And this is not what we're going to actually publish. Because it's, again, very simple, but it kind of captures what we think is going to happen. And indeed, Carl Rodriguez has recently put out a paper that has a distribution like this, kind of from first principles, and that it comes from actual models of galactic evolution. And you find that the peak in the escape velocity on a bimerger basis is a little over 100 kilometers per second. And so it's that model that we're probably going to use in our analysis. But for now, it's good enough. So this is what happens when we apply our model to GWTC3 with that astrophysically informed escape velocity distribution. We find the same things that we were finding before in that your primary spin distribution peaks at zero, but isn't identically zero. But the main takeaway from this is we start to learn something about the maximum mass parameter. So this is the inferred distribution of the maximum mass parameter when using a flat prior, when you turn off the hierarchical channels in orange here, versus when you turn them on in blue here. And you can see that GWTC3 pushes us to a point where our inferred maximum mass really rules out values where we expect it to be from physics. So we're starting to exclude values of the maximum mass parameter below about 60 solar masses, which it is possible to push the maximum mass that high if you move around the reaction rates, but you need to move things around by like 3 sigma to get that high. And while in blue, you can see that once we include hierarchical mergers, we allow for values of the maximum mass around the more physical value of, say, 40 solar masses, though we can't really exclude anything yet, and hopefully we can in the future. Finally, we start finding more hierarchical mergers in our population. The usual culprits are there, 1905-21.
Yeah, sorry, can you go back to the previous slide? Yeah. So with hierarchical channel, why is this maximum mass less constrained? Maybe I'm missing something here.
So it's because you can still have plausible populations where the maximum mass is, say, 80 solar masses, and the relative hierarchical rates are low, so most things end up in the 1G channel. But you can also have what we expect, which is the maximum mass to be around 40 solar masses. And you can now have things be in that hierarchical channel. So it's, I'd say the it's poorly constrained because all of these things are options, but you can see that we're now starting to get to a point where if you exclude the hierarchical channel, you're constrained to what I'd argue is an unphysical range of maximum mass values.
Okay.
So as I said before, we are starting now to find more heavily in favor of hierarchical formation scenarios for our usual culprits. This is primary spin and mass ratio versus the primary mass. And as you can see, as you move towards higher masses, you find more in favor of things being hierarchical mergers. And then also when you move to higher spins and more equal mass ratios in the case of 1G2G mergers. And this is plotting everything that's found to be hierarchical with odds greater than 10 to 1. The other thing to point out is our Bayes factor now, relative to excluding the hierarchical channels, is now in the order of a few thousand. So we really prefer a population that includes these hierarchical channels. Or really, we prefer a population that has an additional higher mass component. Now I'm saying that fits with a hierarchical merger scenario. So as I said, this is preliminary. I'd like to extend this even further because, yeah, it's all well and good to use an astrophysical escape velocity distribution for globular clusters. But as I said before, I don't expect all binary black hole mergers to happen in globular clusters. So we can really extend this model to include field evolution as well as evolution in nuclear star clusters and active galactic nuclei, which should form even more hierarchical mergers because they have very high escape velocities and can retain most of their merger products. And the other thing I'd like to do is extend the 1G-1G mass distribution to extend beyond the gap. So right now it kind of truncates at some maximum mass value, but physics tells us that above, say, 120 solar masses, you'd expect things to start again directly collapsing into black holes. So there should be some members of the 1G-1G population out there. And this would account for an analysis done by Maya Fischbach and Daniel Holtz, which found that if you change the prior on your mass ratio when performing the parameter estimation for 1905-21, you actually find in favor of a heavier primary component and a much lighter secondary component, to the point where the primary component is actually above the mass gap and the secondary is below. So this is the straddling the gap scenario. So by extending the 1G mass distribution, we can kind of capture black holes that may fall into this category. And so with that, I'll leave you with my conclusions for that. Our merger rates can help us constrain our astrophysical models. While they can't pin down broad formation channels on a like broad category of binary black holes, binary neutron stars, and neutron star black hole binaries, we can't rule anything out. We can rule out channels as being dominant, but they could still contribute to the merger rate. But then by looking specifically at subcategories of that rate, we can start to constrain some models. And then finally, dynamical channels, specifically, I think hierarchical channels, are needed to explain some of our observations, specifically the most massive ones. So we find that black holes in the parent stability mass gap can be explained by hierarchical mergers. For a wide range of our model assumptions, we prefer having hierarchical mergers to not, meaning the data fits the scenario where we include them versus exclude them. But that our inference strongly depends on the escape velocity of the dynamical environment. So more work is needed in order to make this a more realistic model. And so with that, I would be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Chase. Aman has a question.
Hi, thank you for the nice talk. I had a question regarding the 1G-1G mass distribution that you were talking about, that extending it beyond the mass gap, 120 solar masses. Like after GW1905-21 and also like subsequent detections in the mass gap, there were also many papers with different stellar evolution or like accretion of black hole, which would predict 1G1G mergers also in the mass gap. So do you think if you include those other formation channels for your 1G1G calculation, would your odds ratio change significantly?
So I think what you're referring to, or at least what I'm aware of, is papers that have looked at, well, what happens if you can build a massive progenitor star through a stellar merger of a helium core with a hydrogen-rich star, so that you don't necessarily, the core isn't in the range in which you'd expect runaway pair production, but the star is massive enough that if you retain the envelope, you form a massive black hole.
Yeah, I'd say that's that, but also the other, like, a gas, a black hole in a gas can, a gaseous environment can accrete, or you can modify the nuclear physics in a low metallicity environment, and you can show that in the low metallicity, you can form these high mass black holes. So yeah, like all these different theories that are out there.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm skeptical as to the accretion, just because it's hard to accrete that much mass. So maybe you could have something that's just below the mass gap and then accrete enough mass to be just above it. I wish I had on hand what the actual typical accretion rate is, but it's pretty low. And when you're dealing with heavy secondary components, the lifetime of that progenitor is really small. So you don't have a lot of the time to accrete that matter. That being said, yes, you can push around the, especially the nuclear reaction rate. Actually, I do have an extra slide for this. This is from a paper by Robert Farmer and others. Let's see. So what's relevant is on the left here, this is, here is your, I guess, whatever the default carbon oxygen rate was. And then as you push that around, you can increase the location of the lower edge of the variance stability mass gap. So the mass gap does not go away in this case. And the one thing to note is you have to push it by like 2 or 3 sigma to account for 1905-21. So I'd say certainly if the reaction rate is that low, then yes, you can explain everything that we have that we've seen so far with hierarchical mergers. But I'd argue if you want to go the other way and use the observations to infer something about the reaction rate, you need to account for the possibility of hierarchical mergers in an analysis like this.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Well.
Thanks for the nice talk. So I'm wondering just if you think about going forward to 04, 05 and start to be completely flooded with events, what do you think is sort of the most promising way to sort of get some like definitive evidence for the fact that some of these have to be hierarchical mergers? I mean, do you think it's to build up some population, like, or some statistics about the spins of the black holes and show that they're, you know, around 0.7, or potentially measuring some residual eccentricity at low frequencies, or what do you think is sort of going to be the first most promising method to definitively say that we have to have these things?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I'd say the first thing that will start helping us not necessarily nail down solidly whether something is hierarchical is constraining the fraction of mergers that happen in dynamical environments. And the telltale signature of this is going to be finding mergers with misaligned spins. So if you've read the LIGO populations paper for GWTC3, we found that the chi-effective distribution, which is a measure of how aligned the spins are with the binary's orbital angular momentum, we found that the minimum chi-effective is probably below 0, which means that there is some fraction that has completely misaligned spins, which means that it likely came from a dynamical environment. But I'd actually say that if we ever want to truly nail down whether an event is hierarchical or yada, 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 it's first going to be done when we nail down what this nuclear reaction rate is. And I believe there are some experiments that are hoping to do this in the near future. The trouble with measuring this reaction rate in a lab is that the effect of cross-section is really low, so you'd have to sit around forever in order to, the effect of cross-section at the temperatures and pressures in a massive core. And so you'd have to sit around forever to really build up any statistics. And so I'm not sure, I don't know the details of that experiment, but I am looking forward to kind of attacking this problem from the other end, the fundamental physics.
So is that something that they'll have results?
I do not know. This is not my area of expertise. I just know in the, I think it was in the paper that included this plot. They mentioned that, but.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Any other questions for Chase? Well, maybe I can ask one more. So I see other people have proposed models to explain why you have black holes in the upper mass gap, right? Like you could have black holes merge with or collide with stars, and that may increase the mass. Or I think Daniel has some model saying that there is some direct collapse without having supernovae, you may produce black holes in the upper mass gap. So, I mean, have you considered like these other models as well? It seems, right, it could be that, right, other things are contributing to these massive black holes, not hierarchical modules.
Yeah, so in this analysis, absolutely not. We have not considered that. Not that, I mean, obviously we acknowledge the existence of those scenarios. It's just that when you look at these black holes in the mass gap, the most obvious way to get them, in my mind, are hierarchical mergers. You don't need to turn the knobs in your model to a very specific range to be able to form these really exotic black holes. We already know that as when black holes merge, they form more massive black holes. So naturally, in dynamical environments, those go on to merge with other black holes. So obviously, this is a very easy way to get hierarchical mergers. But it's not saying it accounts for those other scenarios. So I can't really speak on that. No.
Mm-hmm. And at some point, I guess there should be, a comparison between the measured rate, right? Like if you infer there is some percentage of events are hierarchical mergers, then you have the measured rate, but then you may want to compare with the theoretical rate, either from galactic cluster or nuclear cluster, and see if they match or not, right? Like,
I think absolutely. So this is kind of what my dream is to make this model capture, not everything, but most things. And so I'd love to have I'd love to be able to get a mixing fraction between all of the main formation channels, so isolated binary evolution, you have the land spins, and then the various dynamical channels and globular clusters, AGNs, and nuclear star clusters. And then once we do that, we would absolutely be able to, compare our merger rate to what we find in our gravitational wave observations.
Okay, cool. Well, with that, let's thank Chase again for the nice talk and discussions.